much less terrifying if you just come to me.
Wolfman's got nards!
Make love in the hammock!
What?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Film Actually, episode 70 for the 29th of December, 2011. And once again, we are here for one of our summer season or holiday season shows, which will be a little bit shorter than usual. And I am joined by Skype, Josh Philpott. How are you, Josh?
You know what I love, Dave, about you is the fact that whenever we start a show, the difference in your voice tone between the on-air and off-air, Dave, is actually quite spectacular. You just explode into this, like, welcome to the show.
Well, you know, it's called show business, man.
But anyway, I digress. I'm very good. I'm very good.
That's excellent to hear. We're also joined by Richard Gray. How are you, Richard?
I'm even better now than I was 10 minutes ago.
It's because of my sparkling voice, isn't it?
Yeah. See, this is my on-air voice.
It's invigorating.
My on-air voice is just dryly laconic.
But it's good,
like,
man.
If someone's just passed me a gin and tonic and I've said, hey, I'll have one of those.
Oh, man, keep doing that.
I might have a second.
All right, so this is Film Actually, the official movie podcast of geekactually.com, and we are foregoing what we've been watching in the news and all that other stuff because it is just a holiday season, and we're just trying to get through this slew of films that have come out over December, where we're supposed to be having holidays, but the distributors have all decided that no, they wanted to release all the big films within the space of 2 weeks.
Yeah, a good friend Jorge over at the Spotlight Report left a message on my Facebook page the other day saying, Richard, you don't know it's a Christmas break, right? You can stop.
No such thing as a Christmas break. Actually, we are taking a Christmas break. We should say that right now. We are off air next week, so this is our last one for the year. And then we will be back in the new year with back to properly formatted shows. So, and Richard and I were talking, Josh, and we believe that it is an absolute imperative that we do create the Josh Bargain Bin segment. It has to
Brilliant.
It has to happen.
Because Brilliant.
It is just a sensational idea.
It's just one of those things, isn't it, when you get something like a collection of films. Like, every time I come to the show, I'm going to be bringing something that nobody's bothered to watch. It's just a fascinating concept.
And I actually have one for you. I got one for Christmas this year called Flight of the Dead. And basically, it's described as zombies on a plane.
I like this. Is Samuel L. Jackson perhaps?
He's not. It actually has the only name member of the cast is what's his name? Tyson, the one that was in that Two Moon Junction film. Not Mike Tyson, the other one. No, he was a kind of a hunky stud bucket for a while in the '80s. What's his name? Anyway, I'll see if
Richard
I can look.
Richard Tyson.
Richard Tyson. Thank you.
Yeah. Sherilyn Fenn's in it as well. We have to watch this.
No, she's not in it.
That's Two Moon Junction.
Yeah,
sorry.
Two Moon Junction. I was like, he is in Flight of the Dead.
Yeah, sorry.
And he's looking very puffy indeed. He's not such a stud muffin anymore.
So it's more of just the muffin.
So yeah, exactly. This is where the hunky guys go to die, apparently. To the bargain basement.
The name alone makes me very, very excited.
Oh, yeah, so I'm going to have to – I want to watch it, and then I'm going to pass it on to you to have a look at, because I think this is right up your alley somehow.
Oh, dude, I have all sorts of wonderful things for you in the new year. I have two Pulse sequels that I don't think ever made it out into the light of day, and then on top of that, I have a film that's about somebody being someone trying to kill someone in a parking garage.
All right.
Yeah.
Brilliant. All right, so this is stuff people can look forward to in the coming episodes for the new year with Josh's Bargain Bin Basement Bonanza, I guess we'll call it. All right, so what are we doing this week? This week we're actually reviewing the new collaboration between Steven Spielberg and Peter Jackson, The Adventures of Tintin. And have you guys noticed they seem to have dropped the subtitle?
Yes.
Because it was all the way through production, it was called The Secret of the Unicorn. And then when it finally hit cinemas, it's just called The Adventures of Tintin. Does this mean...
Do you think maybe it's from a marketing point of view, like people that may not know Tintin, it's like... And also we had like Tintin, then like Adventures of Tintin, and then Adventures of Tintin, Secret of the Unicorn. It was just getting too long.
Well, I'm also wondering whether or not, because they originally said they were going to make three of these films, and this was the first of the three, and blah, blah, blah. And then as the production went on, do you think they kind of went, well, maybe if we state right off the bat that we're making, that we're giving it a subtitle, it's almost a little bit too bold.
But again, at the same time, from then on, if you want to do sequels to this film, then you can add the text at the bottom. Because the Adventures of Tintin sets the precedence, and then from then you can start expanding out.
You know what this reminds me of, though? This reminds me a lot of Pirates of the Caribbean, Curse of the Black Pearl.
I was thinking that, yeah.
When they first released that first film that had that subtitle, and you went, why does a first movie have a subtitle? It seems a bit bold to think that we're automatically believing that our film is so good we're going to get sequels out of this.
Well, clearly you've never been to Singapore.
I knew that was coming. I just got to also apologize to our listeners because I'm actually coming off of a really wicked cold. So if I sound a bit rough around the edges, it's because I am. I'm actually much better, but my voice is still a wreck. So
It's rich and fruity, David.
Rich and fruity, is that
wonderful? It's like full jam.
I think it's more fruity than it is rich. But anyway,
it's fruity like jam. I want to put my hand into your voice and massage it.
I would equate it more to raisin toast.
Ooh.
Just saying.
Is it toasted
it's
with
got
both?
That roughness, but then also the fruitiness at the same time?
It really is too late for you guys to be recording a podcast, isn't it?
You guys don't get to talk much. Me and Richard have a lot of food to catch up on.
Yeah, it's true.
All right, so let's talk a little bit about this film. So this first one, because they are proposing three films, is directed by Steven Spielberg and produced by Peter Jackson. Writing credits go to Stephen Moffat, Edgar Wright, Joe Cornish, and of course it's based on the comic book series by, now is it Hirsch? Hergé? How do you pronounce his name?
I'll go with Hergé.
Hergé. Okay, Hergé sounds good. For those who think those names sound familiar, Stephen Moffat is the showrunner for Doctor Who at the moment. Edgar Wright, of course, did things like Scott Pilgrim Saves the World, Shaun of the Dead. And Joe Cornish is kind of the smallest name out of here, but we reviewed Attack of the Block very recently, and he was the writer and director of that. And so this writing crew is amazing.
I like to think of the direction and writing team of this as the dream team.
It's pretty much the creme de creme of Hollywood at the moment, of the movie industry at the moment. So. We'll find out what we all thought of this in just a second, but Tintin and Captain Haddock set off on a treasure hunt for a sunken ship commanded by Haddock's ancestor, but someone else is also in search of the ship. And this comes straight from IMDb, and I think there's so much more to this film.
Yeah, I was about to say, that just ended really abruptly.
And that's all there is. That's all IMDb has put in here. So I think that is really fun. But we'll talk a little bit more about it anyway. We'll watch the trailer first, and we'll come back and talk about what we thought of The Adventures of Tintin. So here's the trailer.
Years ago,
secure the cargo.
A power that could have changed the course of history was lost. Generations have searched for it.
Snowy, look at this. It was long claimed the ship was carrying a secret cargo.
But no one has found a clue. Until now.
The model ship conceals a clue
to one of the greatest secrets in all history.
I'm warning you. Get out where you still can. These people do not play nice.
I will find that ship, with or without your help.
Thanks. I'm Tintin, by the way.
Haddock. Archibald Haddock.
Someone's locked the door.
The key, Snowy. Not the sandwich. The keys.
How could you let them escape?
If Sakharin finds the ship before we do, it's over.
This isn't just the ship. Yours, vengeance.
Tintin,
look.
Okay.
This may sound crazy, but I've got a plan.
Excellent.
Did you hit anything?
Oh, dear.
Land! We're not there yet!
No! Land!
You looked a little cold, so I lit a wee fire.
In a boat? Well, this is a fine mess.
I will contend!
Okay, so that's the trailer. Now, we've all seen this trailer many times since it aired throughout the year. I remember when the trailer came out, Josh, you were actually a little bit disappointed with it.
Yeah.
You actually thought that
the trailers got better as they went along. It was just that first thing how we didn't really see much of Tintin at all. But we'll come back to what I thought when we talk about the film
all
itself.
Right, so what was leading off here was the fact that probably out of the three of us, you were a little bit probably the downest on the trailer the most. So what were your opinions of the final film now that you've finally seen it?
All right. Well, look, I kind of got the same situation I did out of the trailer, which is that I got a lot of show and I got a lot of spectacle, but substance was kind of where I started to, like, where there should have been story and intrigue and kind of like a build, it was kind of replaced with flashy action and silly jokes. Now, I'm not saying that's in no way, I need to start this off with, I'm going to be the hardest on this, but I didn't think it was a bad film. I felt that there was more flash than there was substance.
That's fair.
It's essentially like the action scenes are breathtaking. The graphics are just spectacular. I don't think I've it like a friend of mine that walked out of it recently said it was scarily perfect visually. And I think that's a great way to actually like when you're watching this film, it's surprisingly good. Like it completely out Avatar's Avatar, in my opinion, just for visual spectacle. And I know that we're working with flatter images and there's a lot less on screen, so they can put a lot more effort into the visuals. But I've just never seen anything like it visually. Substance was my issue. I can probably say the other things that I struggled with were the fact that when I was watching the film, there were bits in the middle where I actually started to feel myself get bored. And I don't really know how to describe that considering there was so much action happening. But I think the biggest problem for me for this film was the middle description of the switching between Captain Haddock and his ancestor. I just felt that scene really badly put together.
Interesting.
But anyway, what did you guys think?
Richard, what do you think?
Look, I've seen the film twice now. And I was a bit, bit like Josh the first time I saw it, that I really, really, really enjoyed it. And I thought there was something missing. Now, I should point out, major disclaimer here, that last weekend I managed to pick up a copy of the Australian newspaper, opened up the review section, saw a full-page ad for the Adventures of Tintin in there, and a pull quote from me on there.
Hey, congratulations.
Which was finally made it. Which is something I've been wanting for years, and it said, my pull quote was the best, one of the best action films of the year, was in my pull quote. Now, from that pull quote, you'd think that I universally love the film, but if you actually read my review, I don't. I mean, I actually recommend seeing the film. I actually rate it quite highly, but I certainly don't think it's a perfect film, But I will say up front, my pull quote is correct. I think it is one of the best action films of the year. I think as Josh has already said, the action is spectacular.
Mm. It's just breathtaking. You can't even stop and breathe.
No, and it's kind of like Steven Spielberg of old is back in a way, and it's kind of like all we needed to do was take reality away from him, and he was sort of back to his top early 1980s action form. It's like the first Indiana Jones film.
Mm.
You know, It doesn't let up. I mean, it really has that sort of vibe to it. Some of the problems I have with the film is the first act is incredibly slow. It's the least action-packed, and it's full of exposition. I keep making this gag several times, but you'd be forgiven for thinking that Tintin is Belgian for exposition because he keeps explaining everything. You know, and you know, that's the character of Snowy is there so we can go, look, there's something up on the wall, and if that wall went all the way down to the ground, aha, grass. grass. That means there's probably been mowing here. You know, and it's just like, you know, quick to the library. And it's that kind of thing, and it's sort of like it might read well, but it doesn't translate to the film very well. So when the action scenes do pick up, they do something that you can only do in cinema, which is this amazing set piece action sequences. Now, overall, I think it's actually a really satisfying, fun adventure story, the kind that we haven't had in, you know, a decade or so. It's just that kind of really boy's own adventure sort of thing. And, you know, the source material is an obvious inspiration. It is obviously where they've taken this spectacular stories from, you know, minus the racism, of course, of the original.
Yeah, well, that was the time that they were written as well. So
yeah, exactly right. Yeah. I mean, look, and actually, it's really interesting that they've started from Secret of the Unicorn because it is actually, I don't know about the 12th or 15th. I can't even remember where it runs in the series, but it's well into his original run of books, and it's the first one I think that Haddock's introduced. And that was the first time that they they really wanted to get to Haddock really quickly because he's obviously a favorite character. I think that the motion capture stuff in this is amazing as well. It's like at the start, there's a little uncanny valley, but then after that, you don't notice it at all.
No. It's actually, as far as motion captured films are concerned, with the exception of Rango, but Rango, because they were actually dealing with animals, it was a little bit easier because they had strange eyes anyway. And that was actually almost one of the gags of the film. But as far as motion capture films go, and this is all those Robert Zemeckis films like Beowulf and Christmas Carol and so forth, this is by far the best example of a motion-captured animated film because they've actually brought life to the characters and they don't have the usual Uncanny Valley dead eyes and all this sort of stuff. They've used Weta Digital has used all the techniques they've learned in things like Avatar and stuff like that and applied it to a cartoon. And they've done an exceptional job at that.
Absolutely exceptional.
I'm actually in agreement with both of you on this because I think that as Richard was saying, the first half is dull. And the way I described this film to somebody who asked me about what it was like, I said, look, it's a really good film, and it's probably the prettiest film I've seen this year. It is gorgeous.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just beautiful. And in fact, it's probably one of the prettiest CG films I've ever seen. Just in the texture mapping and the lighting and everything about this film is just gorgeous. I think the motion capture work is brilliant. The problem I feel with this film is probably a problem with the source material to start with. I was a big Tintin fan when I was young, and all that exposition and everything is in the books. And for the books, it works, but they've kind of just translated that straight over, and it kind of does grate on you after a while. And you sit there going, come on, move on. You know, we just want to get the story rolling, you know?
I think coming back to my statement at the start of the film where I was talking about the middle section with the Captain Haddock sequence, I think that's exactly what it is. It's by the middle stage. The exposition, especially in that scene, is almost outweighing what's going on. Like, you could very easily translate that into visual instead of having him explain it out while it's happening.
I agree. And I actually thought that the second half of the film was quite exceptional, and I absolutely in agreement with both of you. I think this is some of the finest action scenes put on screen in a long time. In fact, there are action scenes in this that rival Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I found myself laughing during the scenes just at how incredibly ridiculously action-packed it was.
Yeah, and the setups and the scenarios that Spielberg built into these action scenes, you just sit there going, how much further could you take this, you know? And it's wonderful. It's just this gleeful, joyful moment where you sit there, especially you see part of it in the trailer with the motorbike going down the wire, and you know that is just part of a very long extended action sequence that is fabulous. And you just sit there and you look at this stuff and you go, this is just great stuff. Now, I haven't had a chance to take my son to see it yet, but he's going to adore this film. I can already tell you, he'll just adore it. And you know, it is a film that I would see again easily. But
can I just add, when I saw it a second time, because I was lucky enough to go and see it at a second preview, all those expectations I had going in the first time, I was able to leave at the door.
And that's always a really great thing.
Go with the story. Yeah, and all that action stuff, just actually, I just went with it, and I enjoyed it a lot more the second time. So
yeah,
I
and
think
that's
it
what
is,
I'm hoping as well.
Yeah, I think it is one of those films that you will be able to return to.
And it's kind of how I felt about Real Steel. Remember I said I saw Real Steel a second time with my son, and I enjoyed it so much more the second time because I was seeing it with him and having that adventure with him. And I think that's very much the case of this film as well. I think a second viewing, you leave your expectations at the door, you're seeing it with a target demographic audience, and you sit there and go, and you can see the joy in their eyes when they actually see something like this. The thing I said to my friend was, it's when I was saying it was the prettiest one I've seen all year, I did say the follow-up to that was, the problem that I had with the film is it seems to be missing a heartbeat. Mm. And that is actually one of my problems with the film, is the fact that it is really pretty, it is really stylish, it has great action scenes, but it never touched me. It never actually made me connect with it emotionally. Mm. And I think that's because it just feels there's a vague sense of distance between me and the film. It never drew me into the film. It kind of said, you sit back and watch me.
Part of the problem is that Tintin himself is not that engaging a character.
No, that's true.
Haddock, I found, is, because Andy Serkis puts so much life into his characters. Mm. And you can actually see those little moments when he's going, yes, you know, and that's Andy Serkis, and you can see that in there. Whereas there's too much Jamie Bell in Tintin, and I don't think Jamie Bell's certainly not as experienced as Andy Serkis is with motion capture. Andy Serkis should, you know, as far as I'm concerned, be given awards for his role as Caesar this year. In Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Agreed.
For him to be able to be that versatile in those two different roles. Tintin's just not that interesting a character in and of himself. And we kind of alluded to the fact that in the sort of opening sequence and in the first few scenes that he's had all these adventures already. But you just don't get the impression that he's all that interesting.
And it's interesting. It's really weird because, as a huge fan of the comics, this is actually one of my favorite comics. This one and the one that comes after it are my favorite. But there's this sense as a reader when you get to that stage that you've read all these other ones. So you've seen him go through all these fantastic things and all this sort of stuff. But the weird thing was, coming into the movie, I felt like it was a completely different person to the comics. Just because, I don't know, I think you're right, Dave. There's a feeling Jamie Bell just doesn't add to the character. He's just, is exposition.
And I think essentially one of the problems with the comic book is, you know, being a big fan of the comic book, Haddock was always my favorite character in the comic book as well, and Thompson and everybody else around him. And when you actually start looking at the Tintin comics again, because I've started to actually reread them, it's really interesting because Tintin himself is actually not a very compelling character. He is the exposition man, you know, and it is all of the other characters around him who are bringing the real entertainment value. Now, that works okay on paper, but for the film, we needed to make Tintin, because it is the adventures of Tintin, we needed to make him more compelling. We needed to have, I just don't think Jamie Bell was up to it, quite frankly, because you could have made all that exposition work if you were a more vibrant performer. He could have brought something to that, but it just felt like a reading.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like he's actually doing anything with it.
I will give it a few things. These are a few things that I loved about it. Number one is, I get the sense, though, that if you give a vacant character portrayal like you have, and now that he's had an entire film, if we did do a sequel, I get the feeling that he would probably be able to add a lot more than he did this time. Mm. So there is always a chance that the next film will seem a lot better now that he's had a bit of experience. The second thing that I was really happy about, and again, this feels like a very Jackson influence, is there was none of the rough and tumble pulled out, which was what I was really worried about with making this a kid-style film. Was one thing that I always loved about the comics is that there were punches thrown left, right, and center and guns shot all over the place.
Yeah, it's true.
And I really didn't want to see that removed, and I was so glad to see that they left that intact.
Mm. No, I agree with that. It's nice that they actually went that distance. And I will be curious, because the second film, if it ever gets off the ground, is actually supposed to be directed by Jackson. And I'd be very interested to see Jackson's take on this.
Because that would be Red Rackham's treasure, right?
My assumption would be, yes.
Yeah. Well, they kind of, without any spoilers, if you read the comics, the end of this first film kind of sets it up for that anyway.
Absolutely. So. Mm.
And the other thing is that would be the one, especially with the kind of figures they're doing at the moment, and how successful it seems this film is doing, it would be people would be absolutely dying to see what they would do with the next one, because that's actually my favorite of the two comics is actually the second half. But yeah, I'm really keen to see a sequel, which is weird because it's like I'm almost ho-hum if it wasn't for the action about this film. But at the same time, I'm really dying to see what they would do with the second film.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm actually just looking up Adventures of Tintin right now on Box Office Mojo to see if we can find out what sort of business this thing is actually doing. Because there was actually a lot of worry about this film because Americans don't really know what Tintin is.
Yeah.
That's why it was released in Europe first.
That's right. And you look at the numbers now. Now, this was released on... December 21st in the United States.
That's right.
And according to this, since December 21st, so we're talking, 7 days now, it's actually only made $27 million. However,
I wouldn't count on all the numbers having come in yet because it is Christmas.
However, the most important part here is that it's made $239 million around the world.
Right.
So the big numbers are actually coming in from overseas. They're actually saying that 89% of its box office is actually foreign.
Oh, well.
So
awesome.
And I think it opened in Belgium first out of all countries. So, and it would have done huge business across Europe because Tintin is giant in Europe, you know? It's like the French films of Asterix that had Gérard Depardieu as Obelix. They did huge business in Europe. You know, they did nothing outside of Europe. They did a huge business in Europe, you know. So I don't think we're counting this out. And I think that the film, estimated budget, they don't actually have the budget here, but I think the estimated budget was something like $150 million or something like that. And going by that, we've already made its money at this point. Mm. So I think a sequel is inevitable. So I'd like to see what Jackson does with it. Now, the fact that he was going to direct the sequel was actually all announced. All that sort of stuff came out prior to him basically being drafted back into The Hobbit. So now that he's doing The Hobbit films, will he have time? I don't know.
I'll just get Guillermo del Toro onto it.
Why not? Yeah, he seems to be attached. He seems to be attached to everything else in Hollywood.
So why not?
Why not? So look, my final assessment of this film is: I don't think it is. I was really keen for this film, and I don't think it was. It quite lived up to what I hoped it would be, but it's still a really good film, and I did enjoy it. I just think that it has a few issues that could have been worked out. But I think once you get anticipation out of the way, I think that it is a damn fine family adventure film. What are your thoughts?
I would definitely say that I'm at the point where I would say that I agree with you entirely, Dave. It's a fantastically visual film. You should see it just for that, if nothing else. Mm. Just go in and see it for its visual prowess. And also just because... I don't know. I get the feeling that this could be a good series. Like, there's enough love for it. There's enough people involved that all of these people would come back for a sequel. So go and see it now because I reckon this could be huge in 2 or 3 years' time when we're up to 2 or 3 films.
Agreed. Richard?
I agree with most of what you both said. I think there are certainly problems with the film, but I think it's an amazing adventure film, and I would recommend that people go and see it because it is a lot of fun.
Fantastic. Look, I also want to make a special mention about something as well. Like all of Steven Spielberg films, this is actually scored by John Williams. And I have to say that John Williams' scores of the last probably 10 years have been a little underwhelming. That he's kind of, you can almost feel like his best scores are behind him. But Adventures of Tintin is actually probably one of his best scores in 10 years. It's a really good throwback to when he was doing stuff like Indiana Jones films and stuff like that. It's a really good adventure theme. And he really, it feels like even John Williams really was excited about doing this.
Yeah.
Because I haven't been really inspired by a John Williams score for a while, but I actually went out and bought this one as soon as I could.
Well, it's certainly better than his War Horse score, which is the other Spielberg film. Pardon me. Now, his other War Horse, his other Spielberg score that he did this holiday season, which is very much one of those manipulative, I'm going to hit you over the head with a violin kind of scores.
Yeah. All right. Now, I'd like you to actually give us a mini review of War Horse, if you could, because I couldn't get to it and I really wanted to. And it is a big Spielberg film. I think it was very interesting that two Spielberg films opened on the same day.
Yeah.
Which is a really interesting maneuver. Both two different markets, of course. But
nice bit of counter-programming.
Yeah. So can you I think you were the only one of us that actually got to see War Horse, Richard. Can you give us just a mini review of that?
Look, it's certainly not a bull horse, but it is a flawed horse.
How long have you waited to say that?
This whole time, David. I was embargoed until about a week ago. So. As you know, it's based on a book and a play and a stage play. I don't know which one it resembles more closely. I will be seeing the stage production in London next year, but it's very much a consciously manipulative film, and it has some excellent bits in it, but it is very deeply flawed as well. I don't know if it's one of those movies that you can almost feel the Kleenex company sitting behind it, going, "We're going to sell millions. We're going to sell millions." and you kind of just think, you know, maybe Spielberg's heart was kind of in Tintin at that point, because he's got the two movies coming out, and he kind of thought, "Oh, this adventure stuff, I like doing that. This sentimental stuff, I can churn those out, make a few dollars, but I'll get back to adventure stories." Because it just feels like there's something. It's missing heart. It's like it's there. It's all meant to be there, but it's not.
It's funny because when I saw the trailer for it, I actually said this has got Masterpiece written all over it, or it is going to be incredibly self-indulgent.
And it is the latter, but it's not the thing is, it's not a bad film, and I really want to say that because it's gotten a lot of bad press. There's a lot of people who have disliked this film and are really ripping it to shreds because they feel that it is too manipulative and all those things. I mentioned John Williams' score before as being one of those things. It is really heavy-handed, and the first act is so sentimental it'll give you diabetes. That's how, you know, when it does pick up, there are some wonderful moments. The introduction of Tom Hiddleston, it sort of electrifies the film a little bit more, but all the human characters are transitory. It's about the horse and... it's a good film. Once you sort of get into it, it's a good, solid film. Solid is probably the word I'd use. But I don't think it's a masterpiece.
It's not going to be one of his remembered films, though, is it?
No, certainly not.
Fair enough. Josh, are you going to see War Horse at some point?
No, like you, Dave, the trailer just didn't grab me. I felt that there seemed to be, when I was watching it, it was like there was plenty of, like you said, like Kleenex moments, but emotion seemed to be painted onto it. Like it wasn't so much about the role, it was about these amazing setups which made these tear-jerking moments. So yes. I just looked at the trailer and I was just like, nah, not happening.
Right. Look, if it's Disney, isn't it? Who produced that?
It's a DreamWorks film, but it's being released by Disney
If DreamWorks or Disney is out there and listening and want to send us some in-season passes and let us pass some judgment on this, we will pass our judgment on it. But I don't know if it's one that I'm going to rush to the cinema to see at this point. I just don't know if I've got time. Life is too short at this point. All right, guys. Let's move on to our list of five tonight. Now, this is the big one for the year. Our list of five, this is our top five films of 2011. Now, we've got an interesting dilemma that we have to deal with here. Now, always with these lists of five, we leave it to each one of us to come up with our own ground rules. And Josh and I kind of faced this last year when we were saying, so with our lists of, with our top films of the year, is that films released in this country? Is that films that were made in this year? Exactly where does it count? And last year, I think we said as long as they were released within the year here. But I think this year I'm going to go with the concept that, for me anyway, I don't know about you guys, but I'm going to go with the concept that the four films that were produced in 2011. So yes, some of them we may not get until January, but I won't be able to add them to this list. I'll have to go on to next year's list. What can I tell you? There's nothing I can do about it. There's going to be problems. But I think Richard and I summed it up best when we were talking, and I said, I would have a lot of problems putting a film like Black Swan on a list for this year. Because even though it was released here, it was last year's film. It's already won its Oscars.
Yeah.
You know, it's done. You know, it's awkward. I know, but anyway. So for my list, I have just chosen films that were produced in 2011.
And I'm doing the same thing I did last year and said, to hell with that. If I watched it this year, it's on my list for this year.
Okay, That's yeah. fair. And Richard, how are you doing yours?
Pretty much the same as you, Dave. If it was produced in 2011 and I saw it in 2011, it goes on my list. I did do a separate list for somebody else's site. It was a Sydney Film Critics thing. And I had to do films that were released in Australia this year. So I had to include things like Black Swan and True Grit.
And how'd that make you feel?
Sorry?
How'd that make you feel?
It made me feel awkward. because it is. I mean, look, you're almost doing a year. You're almost doing an 18-month list in that
yeah,
case.
Yeah, and I know it sucks because we live in Australia and this sort of stuff happens. Yeah. And it's going to be really, really awkward because of that. So if you are listening to this and you live in Australia and you say, but where's True Grit? Where's Black Swan? Where's this? They're 2010 films for me. I can't put them on a list for 2011. It's just not fair to the 2011 films. You know what I mean?
And I want to say up front that there's films, as I said, I'm missing out on those films, and they would definitely be on a list if I was doing 2010 films, that's for sure. Mm. But by the same token, I've seen a few films that will be released in early 2012 in Australia already, so they are on my list. By the same token, there are major ones like Hugo and The Artist, which I've not seen yet. And again, they're going to have to.
They're going to go. They're going to go in the
between
limbo.
List somewhere.
Yeah. My way of thinking, though, man, and I'm just using this, especially considering one of these is on my list. Is I've been waiting a year to put one of these films onto my list because I didn't have that option last year.
Yeah, no, that's so, fair. As I say, and
the way that I work on it is that if I couldn't have seen it last year, then how can I class it as last year's film?
Yeah, exactly. I know. That's where these things get really, really awkward. So that's why we leave it up to everybody to interpret this and use their own rules.
Essentially, your guys are wrong and I'm right, so let's just move on.
Okay,
well, we established that months ago.
Yeah, absolutely.
I must have missed that memo.
That's cool. All right. So let's get started here. Let's say I've also got, and I don't think any of you have done it, but I'm just going to do it just for the hell of it. I actually came up with the five worst films of the year as well. I was on a train on the way home tonight and it just kind of hit me. So
I've got a short list so I can give you a few of those.
And I think Josh will agree with all the ones on my list anyway, so it's okay. So we'll run through those at the end as well. I'll start us off. What the hell? And I'll say that my number five for this year, for the top film of the year, is on the list purely because it was the most unexpected film of them all, which was Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Nice.
Because here is a film that I wrote off the minute I heard about it. And when I finally saw it, I went, wow, that is actually incredibly entertaining. And I watched it again the other night, and it's still incredibly entertaining. And I really enjoyed it. So I thought, I look at the top five films of 2011, not from a cinema wanker point of view, not from a point of view where I go, oh, is it a worthy film? Does it forward the human condition? I look at it and go, did I enjoy it? You know, and
I was doing the wanker thing.
Oh, well, that's all right. You are a wanker. Yeah. As far as being a pure enjoyment factor, I think Rise of the Planet of the Apes definitely belongs on my list on my top five. So that's my five. Josh, what's your number five?
My number five is oddly the film which I spoke of so highly and pushed so heavily. But after comparing it to the weight of this year, it's actually sitting at number five, which is Drive.
Wow. I'm stunned.
Loved it as a film. Thought it was fantastic. Thought it was very interesting. It was very, very well put together. It was a great score. It was a great musical soundtrack. It was yeah. a really good total package. But when you just weigh it against everything else that was there, then it goes down to five.
Wow, I'm stunned. I thought it'd be higher on your list.
Mm.
I'm very curious to know what the rest of your films are now.
So, yes,
Richard, you're number five.
My number five is one I know you saw way earlier than me, David, but when I finally did see it, it went straight to number five, which was Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Okay, well, it's interesting you say that because I'm next, and my number four is Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. So,
okay, that's good. We'll talk about it now then.
So we'll talk about it right now because I think it's an exceptional spy film.
It was one of those ones that had so much hype around it, and I came to it thinking, here we go again, but... I mean, it was just one of those films that absolutely floored me. And despite the fact that I had a really bad audience that I saw it with, it captivated me the whole way. You really have to pay attention through. It's one of those films where, and a lot of people have said it, it's naff to say it, but it treats you like an adult.
Well, it's funny you say that because the first thing I said, I came out and I saw it on the same screening as Dwayne from the Lennox Files. And I actually looked at him as soon as I walked out. I went, sometimes it's really nice to see a grown-up movie.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you're treated like an adult and you have to think, you know, and it's a really, really good film for that. Great performances all around, and I love the way it's shot in that kind of grainy brown. Yeah, what was it? The old man's foreskin?
Old man's foreskin, apparently, yeah.
Yeah, apparently. But it's got this kind of gray. This is what apparently the director said he wanted to make it look like an old man's foreskin.
It's foreskin.
So, well, there you go.
So there you go. And it's got
I'd like to think of him going around with like swatch samples.
Now, for the Australian audiences, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy doesn't come out until January. But it has already come out in the States and across Europe. And it was hugely successful in Europe. So no, and it well deserves it. And what an amazingly understated performance from Gary Oldman.
And there's already talk of Smiley's People, which is the sequel, being greenlit. So
I'd be first in line to see it.
Absolutely.
Josh, your number four.
My number four is the film I couldn't put on my list last year, and I just refused to let it go through 2 years without getting a mention, which is Black Swan.
Absolutely.
Aronofsky's fantastic film, really well shot, really well put together, brilliant cinematography, brilliant acting all around, and dark. And we all know I love my dark films. But look, people have been raving about this for, you know, last year as well, so yeah. I'm not going to harp on it.
Well, that's look, all I have Josh, to say. If I was including 2010 films on my list, it would be number one. So
hands down. I actually saw it on New Year's Eve 2010, so... I just missed out on all my lists, but it would be up at number one or two. I think when I did my list of films just released in 2010, it was – sorry, just in 2011, it came in at number two or three, I think, on that list.
No, I thought it was a superb film.
That's how highly I think of that film.
Yeah, no, it's an excellent film. Richard, number four.
My number four was Super 8.
A little bit higher on my list.
Yeah, yeah, I thought it might be a little higher on your list, David. we'll wait till it comes to you to talk about it any day.
There's two of us still to go, so we should hold on that one.
All right, exactly. We'll hold off. Say, like, it was when the film came out, I said at the time it was one of the best. I said it was one of the best films I'd seen this year, and the three films that beat it in my list all came out after it, so I was right at the time.
Fair enough. My number three. Is Burning Man, which I cannot believe that an Australian film actually made my top five list. But this film had a very visceral, emotional reaction with me. And I think that it is an exceptional screenplay, which really captivated me. And I think really, really good performances all around. I know, Richard, you didn't feel the same way. But that's fine. And every film is going to have a different reaction. And when I was telling my mother about it recently, she actually said she probably couldn't even watch this movie because of the reaction that it would have. And I think if you've had in your life situations like in the film, it really does strike a chord. It's almost like striking a raw nerve ending, and it kind of rings through to you. And it really did that. In spades for me, and so I just look at it and go, it's pretty much a masterpiece of a film. Not the highest film on my list, because for enjoyment factor, I don't know if it's a film I would go back to many, many times and watch. You know what I mean? Because it is a tough watch for somebody like me who's been through situations like that. But it is an extraordinary film, and it is one I will buy when it comes out because there are elements of it I want to see again, and a really, really beautifully shot film as well.
It is. I'll give it that. It is a beautiful film to look at.
Absolutely, yeah. Josh, your number three.
Well, my number three is probably going to be the weirdest pick out of the entire year's film for all of us, because I don't think it was possibly thought of. It may have been thought of, but I think probably very immediately discounted. But the horror fan in me can't let this one go. My number three is Fright Night, the remake.
It was close.
Yeah, no, for me, of course, it's the horror fan in me that won't let this one go, because me and you, Dave, went into this with just such low expectations.
Yes.
We were just I had seen the original only recently coming off this, so I had something to compare it to that was very fresh in my mind, and you, of course, loved the original.
Yeah.
And I just looked at it and went, the videos look bad, the trailers look bad, the character casting just looks wrong, and everything just worked.
Agreed.
Like, nothing about this film was bad.
No, I agree. And it was actually one of those films where one of the key elements of Fright Night, the original Fright Night, was about the humor, and none of the trailers had any humor. It was like they were playing the whole thing dead straight. And I looked at it and just said, you've completely missed the point of this. And when I went to see the film, and was so surprised that it did have a sense of humor, and in fact, a really good sense of humor. And I just enjoyed it thoroughly. No, I agree with you. That was a terrific film.
And I think this film made it onto my list entirely on the fact that I finally got to see David Tennant swear and just be absolutely crass. So I think that's what pushed it onto the top 10 of the year, top 5 of the year.
Fair enough. Richard, you're number 3.
How did I forget Fright Night? My number 3, it's time to start the music.
Ah.
It's the Muppets. The two films that beat this out are very serious films. I have not walked out of a film with a bigger smile on my face in years. It was the most joyous film of the year. The music, the songs, the dancing, the laughter. It had it all. It was that nostalgia only got it so far. The rest of it was pure writing, and it was just a really clever, smart, funny, self-referential film. It really harks back to the old Muppets film. I just watched The Great Muppet Caper again the other day from 1981, and it's kind of like that is still really sharp and really clever, and I expect this in another 30 years' time to be as sharp and clever and still be as fresh, because there's nothing terribly modern about the film. It's got this very modern sensibility, but that's because the Muppets are timeless. And if I say anything more, I'm just going to be gushing completely, but it's which I'm already doing.
Well, look, I actually have it in my honorary mentions list. It didn't quite make my top 5, but I really love the Muppets this year.
It took me so I really wanted to like it, but then the fact that I loved it so much surprised me. So
I still stand by I think it's the feel good film of the year.
It is the feel-good film of the year, and just the fact that it had songs by Brett McKenzie from Flight of the Conchords sort of just took it to that next level. So you've kind of got this thing there for adults and kids. Kids won't get all the references, but adults won't get all the references either. So it's great. There's a balance. There's a nice balance in there. Okay, I loved it. Joy.
Joy, absolutely. All right, so that brings me to my...
It's sensational, inspirational, celebrational, and definitely Muppetational.
Oh, my God. All right, my number 2. This is probably controversial, and neither of you will have this on your list, but as a comic book fan, my number 2 is Captain America, the First Avenger, purely because... Wow. I absolutely adored this film because it is pure comic book. And for me, it is actually one of the closest things to comic book on screen that I've seen yet. And I just had, I actually, like you with the Muppets, Richard, I had a smile on my face the entire way through it because I actually thought this was a film that was going to just die. I didn't think they'd be able to pull it off. And I really, really enjoyed it. And yes, there's a couple of little flaws in it here and there, but I actually watched it again 2 nights ago on Blu-ray and still had a ball. And all I could think was, I just really love this film. I love the tone of it. I love the action in it. And I just really enjoyed it.
I think it's the best superhero film this year.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I really, really enjoy that film. It would be on my extended list.
Right.
It is such a great... I'm like you. I was surprised by how good it actually
I think
was.
I think it's... Look, I'll go so far as to say that I think it's actually probably the best superhero film since 1979 Superman.
Ooh. Oh, that's too big a call for me, but I certainly think it's, given that it could have just been a complete jingoistic nightmare.
It could have been. It could have been camp. And if anybody
well, it has been in the past. We've seen it.
I was going to say, anybody who's seen the 1990 Captain America knows that this can go horribly wrong. You know what I mean? So, I was very, very, very happy with what they did with it. I think it was they just got it right, and I really enjoyed that about it. So... that's why it's my number 2. Josh, number 2.
My number 2 is Rango.
Yes!
I fucking adored this film. I really did. This film, like you, Dave, I recently watched this again. This would be my third time watching this now. And there is just no point in this film left without something for you. Like, if you go back and you're watching it again, there's references to everything you can possibly imagine. There is visual and audio gags throughout everything. You've got characters playing the kind of roles that they would usually play, but everything's just larger than life. And you just have the most ridiculous things in this film, and yet nothing ever skips a beat. Like, nothing ever feels off key or out of place. And even when out of nowhere, we have Clint Eastwood, voiced by Timothy Oliphant, rolls up in a golf cart full of awards.
Yeah, I love that.
You don't question it. You don't think twice about it because it's just perfect. And to have this come out of the Nickelodeon camp, yeah, just immediately set them on my radar now. So when films come out by these people, they will be on my watch
also,
list.
Also, I mean, this was also marked Industrial Light and Magic's first foray into doing an animated film. Mm. And they just kind of threw down the gauntlet. You know?
Yeah, and that was my other thing, is just visually it is just stunning. Like, I bought this on Blu-ray and it is just absolutely gorgeous to watch. And the visual level is, like you say, it's unbeatable until you watch Tintin. And then it's maybe the second best one of the year, but it's still everything else to go with that just makes it amazing.
Although now you bring up Rango, there are elements of Rango that are actually better than Tintin as well, though.
Absolutely.
Some of the visuals in Rango are stunning. You know,
you know what? I think that Rango has kind of got a more realistic look than Tintin, and it's going for that very realistic look. And I think it does outshine it on that level. They're very different looks. For me, Rango is just behind Drive outside of my top five. Mm. It's right up there. It's heavily in my top 10 for the year.
It's number two on my honorary mentions list. It really...
It basically would be number two on my honorary mentions list for this, yeah. So it's a... I was floored by it. As a huge Spaghetti Western fan, this is the best Spaghetti Western that we've had in years.
Yeah,
you know, and the best Western we've had in years. You know, and I'm
circular life. Anyway,
and it's great. I mean, look, everything. And Josh is right. Everything about it is perfect.
Yeah,
and why it's not higher on my list? Having said that, I don't know.
Well,
it's strange because it's the kind of film that does fall to the back of your mind, but when you think of the amount of work done on all the individual bizarre looking townspeople. And how they somehow still manage to make every one of them adorable, I don't know. And it's just, I watched it again and went, I can't leave this off my list.
Yeah. And all the cinema references in it as well, like to Chinatown and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, it was a very, very loosely veiled remake of Chinatown.
But I think it is very much a, I mean, as you said, Clint Eastwood with a golf cart full of awards. It's a film lover's film.
Yeah, it is. No, it's gorgeous.
And I think this actually marks a turning point in marketing animation to adults as well.
Yeah.
Mm.
You know, so I hope to see more.
No, it's fantastic. Richard, you're number two.
Okay, now
let's see what beat Rango. Come on.
Yeah, now we're into film wanker territory here.
Oh, dear.
Number two is by your favorite director and my favorite director, David, Lars von Trier.
Oh, yeah, okay.
It's Melancholia is number two on my list.
You having Melancholia on your list, a Lars von Trier film on your list, is kind of like me having Burning Man on mine, I guess. So.
Yeah, except your film actually starts with someone masturbating and.
Yeah, and your film is just about
an
intellectual masturbator. Yeah,
exactly. Lars von Trier is very much a take him, like him or hate him prospect. And he's had moments like his last movie, Antichrist, turned a lot of people off, and before that, Mandalay, it was one of the few films I've not made it all the way through.
Or Dogville before that.
I feel like quite enjoyed. I think Breaking the Waves is brilliant. And Dance in the Dark is certainly an ambitious film as well. But Melancholia is something else entirely. This is a Lars von Trier we haven't seen before. The opening sequence is of two celestial bodies colliding. This slow motion shot of Kirsten Dunst running in full wedding gown through across this grassy area, and she's tied back by roots and leaves and things, and everything's running in slow motion. It's just kind of great, terrific montage of the end of everything. And then we go back and get a far more familiar-looking Lars von Trier film with a handheld camera and so forth. But I don't know. It's a beautiful... Look, there's a line from the film which I'll say, which sums it up for me nicely, which is, melancholia is going to just pass right in front of us, and it's going to be the most beautiful sight. And that's kind of how I felt about this film. So
it's interesting. I still haven't seen it yet. And it's one of those films where I sit there and I go, I know I have to watch it. I know I have to watch it. I know I have. But it just... Trier's name on it just holds me back. It really does.
I think
does.
You said once before, and in reference to another film that may be higher on my list, that it feels too much like homework.
Yeah, it kind of does.
Yeah.
And that's the problem I have with it. So, I don't know. I will get to seeing it. I'm sure I will get to seeing it at some point. But look, if you loved it, that's perfectly fine.
Ooh, that grated coming out of your mouth.
It did.
We disagreed before, David.
We have disagreed before, and that's fine. You know, it's a completely subjective media, and everybody can love what they want to love, and that's fine. I mean, I don't expect anybody else to have Captain America on their top five list of the year. You know what I mean? It's something that appealed to me personally. You know, and for you, it's Melancholia, and that's fine. I just once again, thank you.
Well, you can stop giving him reason to let him have it on his list.
No. What I'm saying,
fucking list.
All right. What I'm trying to say is that you know it's a film that I haven't seen, so I can't actually make much judgment on it. And I could watch it and turn around and go, "Oh my god, that was the best thing I've ever seen." But I haven't seen it. So, Josh, are you hanging out to see Melancholia?
I will probably end up seeing it because me and Richard both do sit quite similarly on the art wankery side of films.
Yes.
Right, so I definitely have to see it.
Lars von Trier, dude.
I know, but my agreeance with Richard's love of this kind of film unfortunately leads me to believe I'm going to like it.
I was going to say this is unlike any other Lars von Trier film.
I think we should regroup after all three of us have seen it and actually do a review.
Okay. All right, sounds good.
Sound good? All right, that's a challenge.
Can we move on with this list?
All right, my number one, and I think judging by what we started with on that, is also Josh's number one. So
that would be correct.
That would be Super 8, J.J. Yep. Abrams' homage to 70s, early 80s Steven Spielberg movies.
Now, Dave, I'm going to let you finish, and I'm going to let you do your thing, but can I just open this one?
Sure, go for it.
Go for now, it, Kanye.
Yeah, in putting this at the top of my list, the main reason is that it's something that I think me and Dave were talking about at one stage, and we were saying how cinema experience is all really about it's about the spectacle, it's about full use of a cinema, and I can't say that there are very few films, probably since Jurassic Park, that have just left me on a high for days after seeing it. And that is exactly what Super 8 gave me.
Yeah, I know. I agree. I agree 100%.
That's why it had to go on the top of my list. Like, I looked at all the films I was putting it against, and some of them have better aspects, absolutely. But the one thing that this film has is that this can be universally appealing. And that puts it at the top of my list. It's like, obviously, you know, not necessarily universally appealing to the point where everybody thinks it's the greatest film ever, but I don't think there are many people out there that wouldn't enjoy this film at all. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree. No, I actually put it on top of my list because it was, for me, probably one of the most satisfying cinema experiences I've had all year, where I sat down, I watched it, and when I walked out, I just went, I could just walk in and see that again right now. I just adored it. I adored the acting in it. I adored the story. I adored the adventure. But most importantly, it took me back to a place which is quite possibly my favorite moment in cinema history.
That period of time,
and it just captured the flavor and the heart of that period of time absolutely perfect. Somebody once said it was a love letter to Spielberg, and it so is in every way. And it just touched me on a very, very emotional level. I just loved it. I just adored it. And then to take my wife, who was also a fan of that era of film, and my son, who really didn't know much about that era of film, and to have all of us just walk out just with that aura around us, where we're just kind of going, oh my god, that was so much fun, you know. It was fantastic. It was a real throwback to a period of time. We don't make movies like that anymore. And it was great to see somebody do it. Richard, you had this on your list as well.
I had it at number four, and I think it's easily one of the best films of the year. I mean, it's just Actually, I'm looking at my... I didn't even realize that's actually what I've said in my little thing I've written on my site here. It's easily one of the best films of the year. Look, it is. And it's just when it, as I said, when it came out at that time of the year, I thought, well, that's my favorite film of the year so far. And that was in June. Mm. And only three films have come along since then to that made me think that they were better than that in some way, shape, or form. So, look, it's an amazing... As you said, it's a love letter to all those films that I already loved. And it doesn't just kind of like try and recreate them and do a pastiche of them. It actually gets what makes those films work, and lovingly recreates them for the modern age, and cleverly sets it in that era, so you don't have to worry about all the thing. When we all managed to speak to J.J. Abrams earlier in the year, and he said that, you know, the cell phone is the death of drama.
One of the best quotes I think I've ever got out of an interview. Mm. It's just so good.
I know, it was wonderful, yeah. And look, just to have that freedom just to set a film like this in another time and then just have this boy's own adventure that is, as David said, is just kind of something that everybody can enjoy.
Do you know what's really interesting is that I was actually umming and ahhing about this.
It was me that said that, just saying.
No, it was Richard. It was Josh that just said that, but that's all right.
as Josh was just saying. Yeah.
I was actually umming and ahhing about this top five list a couple of days ago, and I was kind of shifting things around and moving around. Super 8 was always on the list, but it was kind of moving around. And I actually watched Super 8 again last night. It was like I bought it on Blu-ray and I actually watched it last night. And as soon as I watched it again, it went straight to number one. It's like without a hesitation, I just went, okay, that's right. I remember now. It's like I remember why it was supposed to be sitting at number one. And I don't know why I was ever doubting that. You know, so it is a terrific film. It is my film of the year. I don't think I've had the same experience as that film for any other film this year. And it's that where it grabs you and just goes, you know, this is pure entertainment, you know? Mm. And I love that. But I really want to know, because that's also your number one, Josh. So I really want to know what Richard's number one is.
My number one, well, and if the only thing that could beat out something like that in a year like this is if Terrence Malick had a new film out.
Oh, okay.
And so The Tree of Life is
more homework
film this year. More homework. Man.
I really have to see this film.
Look, it's really literally unlike anything else I'd ever seen. And I saw this with a festival crowd, so a very different crowd to your typical cinema audience, and it's certainly not the sort of film that would turn up with, you know, in your big multiplexes anyway, which is a real shame because it's one of those films that needs to be on as big a screen as possible because it's kind of the film that I feel as though this is the sort of film that cinema was created for, and it's just like everything about it is beautiful. It's basically. I might have said this months ago when I was first on the show that it's a wank, but it's a beautiful wank. And
yeah,
it's
I remember
very,
that.
And it's very consciously Terrence Malick is pretentious, but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing in this case. And he has the story of this family in the 50s set against the creation of universe and the meaning of existence, and it has this almost like a two separate short films at the beginning and the end showing the creation of the earth, and this bit with Sean Penn as well, and everything about it is just, you can see that Terrence Malick had been thinking about this film for those 25 years that he was off in the wilderness, you know. It is the film of a filmmaker who was a filmmaker to their core.
Yeah, I'm actually dying to see Tree of Life. It's one of those films that I missed at the cinema, and I really want to see it. But once again, like we've said before, it really feels like it's a film that I need to be in exactly the right place to watch, you know?
And it's not going to be for everyone, and I totally get that. And this is a really big wanker film to put on a list, but you know, I'm just joining all the other film wankers who are doing it as well. But it's got some terrific performances in it. So to me, though, I've in the same way that I walked out of The Muppets on a complete joyous high, and on the same way that I walked out of Super 8 on a complete adventure high, I walked out of this on a completely different kind of high, and I felt moved in a way that I still can't quite explain. I had an emotional reaction to a film, and I think that's always an amazing thing when that happens. So, look, there was no question. Once I saw this film, nothing's come along since then.
I'm looking forward to seeing it. I've got to get around to it. Yeah. Josh, we've got to get around to seeing this film.
Agreed. We might have to have a show about film wankery.
I think so. Yeah. I think we're going to have the intellectual masturbation show.
Dude.
Nice. Yes. Call it that, the intellectual masturbation special.
Absolutely.
I'm just so okay with that.
Yeah. I've got a couple honorary mentions I want to throw out there just because some of these titles have been mentioned already. They are films that I did consider and I just didn't quite make the list because, there was some good pedigree this year. But I had Rango on my list. I had The Muppets on my list. I also had The Guard, the Irish film, which I absolutely adored. It didn't quite make the list, but I really did enjoy it. I also had Kevin Smith's Red State. As an honorary mention, because I actually really like that as well.
I'm surprised that actually wasn't higher on your list.
When you consider what I had on my list, it just didn't quite make it. But it was a highlight of the year for me. And I also had Thor. Now, I had Thor purely because it actually holds a very special place for me because it's where we all met.
It's true.
You know
what I mean? Yeah.
So it's kind of the Thor actually marked the beginning of a... Thor marked the beginning of a very...
There was a time when we didn't know each other.
That's true. But it also kind of marked the beginning of a turning point in all of our sights and everything. So it kind of was an important film for that. And also, I really enjoyed the film.
It was our first big junket, but don't let anybody know that.
Well, they can know that. If they look at my site, they'll know that.
Right? That's true.
I also want to throw out very quickly five of the worst for the year and just see if you guys agree with these. I'll just do them very quickly because we are running late. Number five, Abduction.
Yeah, it's on my one. Yep.
Number four, Shark Knight 3D.
Oh, yeah.
Number three, Conan the Barbarian.
Yes.
Number two, Cars 2.
Didn't see it.
And number one, Transformers Dark of the Moon.
They're all on my worst list. I'd like to add in Sanctum.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I'd like to add in Battle Los Angeles, although I know you guys feel differently.
Yeah, I know. Josh agrees with you. I feel differently.
Sucker Punch, I'm going to throw in there.
Oh, fuck yes.
Yeah, no, I put that on the worst of the year.
What's Your Number?
Oh, yes. I forgot about that. Put that under my brain, that's why.
Your Highness.
Yes.
And I love that film.
Josh liked that one.
Yeah, sorry, Josh.
That's all right, dude. I'm alone on that one. I know that.
Can I just quickly throw in for the best list just a few runners up because I really want to mention these. We've already mentioned Drive, Rango, Rise of the Planet of the Apes as ones that we all think highly of. They're also in my – they're basically 6, 7, and 8 on my list.
Right.
9 and 10 is Midnight in Paris, Woody Allen's film.
Really enjoyed that, yep.
Really lots and lots of fun. And Red Dog, Australian film.
Haven't seen it.
Just because it was purely joyous for me. So.
Yeah, so many people raved about the film. I've got to see it because I actually missed the screening of it. When I booked in, it was already full, so I couldn't get into it.
There you go. Mm.
So, and everybody's raving about it, and it's like, I really kind of feel like I have to because the trailer did nothing for me.
Also, can I just throw out Anonymous because it was one of the few films that surprised me completely this year.
Yeah. No, I actually did. That was on my shortlist at one point. I actually ended up deleting it because I didn't think it was quite up there, but I agree with you. Yeah, it was a surprise.
It's kind of in my best of the rest sort of list. But I just, it was one of those films that completely took me by surprise. So I just thought, it's not gotten a lot of mentions at this time of the year. But
Can I just throw out there that I think this has actually been, in going back and looking on it, is actually been a really good year in film.
It has been.
We've had some really good stuff out this year, and we've had some pretty poor stuff as well. And let's not forget Bad Teacher. You know,
God, yeah. I'm gonna add that to my worst list, the worst of the year list.
I'll tell you what, another film that almost made honorary mention, it didn't get there, but it almost made there. I was truly thinking about the Steve Carell film at one point, Crazy Stupid Love.
Good Love, yeah.
I really enjoyed that this year too. So there was some really interesting films out this year, I think, and some real turning points in people's careers, like with Drive, you know, and you sit there and go, yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see what 2012 does now.
Yeah. Can it up the stakes?
Certainly in terms of blockbusters, it will.
Yeah, well, we've got, I mean, geek films, absolutely. I mean, geek films, we've got Prometheus and The Hobbit, and, you know, we got some big stuff coming out, you know?
Oh, we've got massive. We've got the Avengers, we've got Dark Knight Rises, we've got Spider-Man, we've got new James Bond film out next year.
Oh, that's true. The question is, everything around that. Oh, we've also got the new Pixar film, Brave.
Brave, yes.
So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of good stuff coming out next
year.
Frank
and Winnie.
All right, maybe you're pushing a friendship there. We got two Snow White films coming out as well.
Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter.
And Abraham Lincoln.
And Lincoln, that's right.
Yeah, Lincoln. I think they should release those on the same day.
Oh, and let's not forget, because this is coming out really early next year in the States, but it hasn't got a release date here yet, but I'm really curious. Red Tails, the Lucasfilm film.
Oh, yes, I really want to see that. Yes, that's coming out in March, isn't it?
It is a Lucasfilm.
You know what? It's not directed by him, though, and Lucasfilm as a production company has produced some damn fine films.
We'll see.
That film actually...
It has Cuba Gooding Jr., so just saying.
Yeah, but it looks...
As long as it stays away from being too Lucas-y, which it probably won't because it's a Lucasfilm, but...
And ILM stuff looks great, though. Come on, that dogfight footage is amazing. So, I'm hoping it'll be a really good, fun adventure film.
It'll look good on the first two edits of it, and then by the time we get the third edition, we mightn't like it as much.
It's like that Big Bang joke where he says, let's watch Star Wars on Blu-ray before Lucas decides to change it again.
Yeah.
One of the best jokes of the year. All right, guys, we're going to finish this up because it's late. If you agree or disagree with anything we had to say today, you can send your feedback to feedback@filmactually.com or leave us a voicemail at 02-801-1316. Josh, where can people find out more about you on the internet?
Well, Raw DLC is pretty quiet right now, but head over in about a week's time. We've got all sorts of interesting things and also an opinion coming up this week, which is what your top of 2011 was. And we're getting a community response on that, which we'll be doing on our next show, which will be at the start of the year. So rawdlc.com, check it out. And yeah.
Cool. And Richard, where can people find out more about you on the internet?
They can find me on therealbits.com. That's RELBits.com. I've got my full top 10 of the year up there as well, along with a whole lot of honorable mentions. And I've also just about to post, it'll probably go up tomorrow, is my most anticipated for 2012. And as we've already said, it's going to be a huge list. You can also find me on Twitter at DVDBits.
Fantastic. You can find out more about me by just heading over to geekactually.com, click the follow us button on the side of the page, and you'll find my Twitter account, my Facebook, and all that other wonderful stuff. We also have to put in a shameless plug here and say you should be listening to Behind the Panels, our comic book podcast that we put out every week. We are taking 1 week off from that at the moment, but you can find that on iTunes at Behind the Panels, or go to geekactually.com. That's where we publish it. So with that being said, I want to wish everybody a very happy new year. We hope that 2012 brings everything that everybody wants. I think it's going to be a much better year than 2011. I think 2011 has been a very interesting year. It's been a very hard year. So great year for film. So I'm hoping 2012 will bring lots of cheer and happiness.
And to all our viewers as well.
To everybody.
Listeners. Whatever.
It used to be viewers. So to everybody, have a great and happy new year. And stay safe over the holidays, guys. And we'll be back in 2 weeks is our plan at this point. We're taking 1 week off after this. And we'll be back. So we're talking, what, the second week of January. Is that what we're saying?
Sounds about right.
Sounds about right.
You're the one running the show, Dave.
Oh, I know. I don't have a calendar in front of me and it's midnight. Give me a break. Everybody have a safe holidays. We'll talk to you soon. Keep your eyes on the feed. Bye, everybody.
Bye.